So as we introduced, we're going to be talking about both open source and open standards within virtual worlds. There's actually quite a lot of proprietary software out there as well, which is based on open standards. And we want to go through a bit of that to expose people to what's going on out there in the virtual worlds community.
Can I just add at this time that we'll take questions throughout, so if anybody has something that they're just dying to ask, you can just stick your hand up or ask it or something, and we won't kill you, promise.
So we both work for the IBM Australian Development Labs. We're logically in IBM part of an organisation which works on 3D internet and digital convergence, which was started up kind of the end of 2006 when IBM realised that the 3D internet virtual worlds was going to be quite a big growth area. I'll prefix this by saying that although we work for IBM, a lot of these, our views on these various standards and software are our own. They don't necessarily represent IBM's views. So just a bit of a summary of what we're going to talk about. Unfortunately, I'm not seeing the same slides on the laptop here, so I'm going to be looking around back at the screen again quite a bit.
Anyone who caught Glenn Whitewick's talk on home automation yesterday would have seen the same problem. We can have a very nice view of my cute little kitten, but not as nice.
So we'll go through a bit about what virtual worlds are and why we should get involved in virtual worlds as a community. Cover some of the standards, some of the ISO standards such as VRML X3D on virtual worlds. Second Life is obviously a very large thing out there. It's probably the most popularly known virtual world used by non-technical people as well as technical people. Let's go through some of the other open source and open standards virtual worlds. And some things in the end, there's often some interest about what IBM's doing around open standards and open source and virtual worlds. So we'll cover a little bit about that as well. So just to start off, how many people here have tried a virtual world out, you know, Second Life or that kind of thing? So yeah, quite a few people. That's great. So in its kind of simplest form, the really simple ones tend to be almost just like chat rooms with a little bit of 3D tacked on the end. And in fact, we'll see later, some of them are literally that. They can work in 2D mode where it's much like IRC and you have different rooms. And they've just put a 3D client on top of that. And you don't have to use the 3D client, but you can. They're also not necessarily 3D. The most, I guess, famous ones tend to be 3D, like Second Life or Active Worlds. But it's not necessary to get that kind of feeling of immersion and social interaction, which is one of the most important parts with virtual worlds. One of the big examples of that is Club Penguin, which is really just kind of a flash-based thing. It's for kids. It's simple to use. And one of the problems with a full 3D immersive environment is if you're having a 5 or 6 year old trying to move themselves around that kind of environment, it can get quite difficult just from a coordination point of view of moving the mouse at the right time and looking around correctly. So a lot of the kids ones are in fact 2.5D based, so flash based view from isometric view, and you can kind of move your little penguin around with Club Penguin, this little picture down in the bottom left corner there.
Very cute.
So you can go from different room to room and talk to other people in there. Now, I guess that got a lot of press last year because Disney bought that for $600 million last year. So they obviously see a lot of potential in virtual worlds from there. One big difference between a virtual world platform and, say, an MMORPG like World of Warcraft or Lord of the Rings Online is that they're not necessarily role-playing. They tend to be more of a platform to put things on, so you may have role-playing scenarios in terms of learning and training. But I like the analogy of it's very much like the internet. There's a platform there, there's web servers, you can visit different sites, but there's no overall goal there to go over there and kill a big dragon and go up levels. There's nothing like that around. People do build games in these virtual worlds, but it's not something which is required of the virtual world. In terms of maturity of the technology, it's very early days. There's a lot of players in the market, a lot more jumping in. Every other week there's a new virtual world announced somewhere. Many of them are proprietary, both in source, there's no source available, and works on proprietary protocols too, because they really haven't been bedded down well yet.
When will they learn?
Yeah. I guess part of that is because it's so new, people see a big advantage in doing a tailored thing. There's to get in the really advanced graphics and communication, people were moving outside of the standards at the moment because they're not fully developed. One of the big things about virtual worlds, and I think one of the most important things about the successful ones compared to the not so successful ones, is the ability for user-generated content. There's, you know, a few out there now popping up which are basically read-only worlds. And although they get people visiting, I think for the kind of the long-term health of the platform and the worlds, you really need to allow people to generate their own content. They've got a reason to stay there, a reason to come back and build their own things and share it with friends. And I think that's the major reason that things like Second Life are getting so much press, as opposed to a lot of the virtual worlds which are based on standards, like say X3D based ones. Because it's so much easier to create content for non-technical people in places like Second Life than it is to, you know, get a copy of Blender or Maya and start generating models that way. Okay, some of the differences of a virtual world and a website. I guess there's people out there, you know, saying, you know, what's the point of virtual worlds? It's a much more social kind of experience than going to a website. You go to a website, there might be tens of thousands of people at that website, but you don't know who else is there. You'll be, you know, looking at a certain thing, and you can't tell that other people are interested in the same thing because you have no sense of feeling of other people being at the same place. Most of them, you get a consistent shared view of the environment. So if you're looking at a box over there, someone else is seeing exactly the same thing except from a slightly different point of view. And that's actually a really valuable thing. It's immersive. A lot of the social interactions are very much like you'd have in real life. They did a study, I think it's probably a year ago or so, on how people stand within Second Life. So you have your little avatar within this virtual world, and people get around in circles, and they can measure distances between, say, male and female avatars. And they notice that, just like in the real world, in the virtual world, male avatars tend to stand a little bit further apart than female avatars. It's just that it becomes so real feeling to people within these worlds that they do the same kind of things that they would in the real world.
Just like in the real world, you wouldn't normally be standing next to somebody like this talking to them because it's too much personal space invasion. They seem to stand apart.
Okay, so the open source community, why should we be involved in virtual worlds? Especially in the early days, I talked to quite a few people and they said, you know, it's just a toy, it's just a game. Why should the open source community be interested? You know, we've got websites, we've got mailing lists, we've got millions of ways to talk to each other. Where's the value here? Oh, I think, you know, conferences like LCA are a great example of why virtual worlds could be valuable to us. In a way, these kind of talks, you know, they could be streamed over the internet, you could be sitting at home, or you could see it, you know, 2 weeks later, and you'd get the same technical content brought across to you. You know, why did you come to LCA? What's the value that you saw in it? And a lot of that isn't so much the talks themselves, it's the interaction in the talks and the way that you can talk to people next to you within a talk, or you can talk to them, you know, during the lunch breaks or the morning tea breaks. And it's those kind of discussions which many people find really valuable. And those are exactly the kind of things which you get to do in virtual worlds. One thing we do within the companies, we have meetings, virtual meetings, within places like Second Life. And, you know, if you have a conference call, everyone tends to dial up a couple minutes beforehand. You tend to get put on hold until the moderator comes on. And you talk for 30 minutes or an hour or 2 hours, and then everyone hangs up. But when it's in a virtual world, people arrive, you know, 5 minutes early. They'll see each other around the meeting room, and they'll start talking to each other. So a lot of that communication, which you normally get in real-life meetings, suddenly you can get in virtual meetings as well. And I think that's important for our community. So we can bring people together from around Australia, around the world, to have these kind of meetings, even though we're a very disparate kind of group. There's also an opportunity for the open source community to shape how virtual worlds develop. At the moment, you know, one of the things I really worry about is that we're going to end up in a very proprietary world out in the virtual world space, and that the open source community will kind of wake up in a few years' time. Virtual worlds will be used a lot out there, and they'll find that they need to reboot to Windows to be able to use it, because there aren't the open clients out there, because we haven't developed open source ones. And you can kind of see that happening already in that a lot of the virtual worlds being released at the moment have Windows-only clients. They don't even support macOS many of the times. The servers often run on Linux, and so they see the value of using open source software, but they don't yet see the value of providing open source clients much of the time. So open source within Second Life, this is just kind of an example of how the open source community is to some extent getting involved. Within Second Life, you actually see quite a lot of GPL code out there, which is really interesting. When I first got into Second Life, it was great to be able to wander around there, find something that's like a GNUB store, which isn't really associated with GNU, but they do distribute objects for free, objects which are, or scripts and programs which are, you know, freely modifiable, and many of them have the GPL at the top of the scripting licenses. It's also a very kind of helpful, active community, and compared to some other, I guess, more closed, proprietary-feeling worlds, you get a lot more help, and I think they really gain from being open and friendly to the open source community. One of the problems in Second Life, at least, though, is, you know, how do you enforce these kind of GPL licenses within a virtual world? It's a little bit different from the, I guess, real world, where you can download even binaries and you can start analyzing them to see if someone's been using your GPL code. You can't really do that, or not with any great ease within the virtual world, unfortunately. The other thing is that because the GPL isn't well known outside of the open source community, although there's people interested in sharing their information, often they're shared more on the basis of free as in beer rather than free as in speech. So there's a lot of free objects out there which aren't modifiable, unfortunately. And I think a bit of education of the community within there, they'd be quite happy to. They just kind of don't know, or they haven't seen the benefits of sharing on the source level and object level as well. Unfortunately, you know, the permissions regime within these virtual worlds, like Second Life, tend to be fairly coarse too. So you can set the permissions whether people can copy objects or they can transfer it to other people. And there's no click box yet for saying, you know, this is GPL, make sure that people can share it, but they can't remove those freedoms from other people. So there's just a few examples of other communities, open source communities within Second Life. There's a free software school. You'll see a lot of these kind of environments tend to be classroom type settings or meeting rooms. And this is because although they have information and there's links to stuff about free software, the primary use of the area is actually socialization and talking to people. So people doing presentations, those kind of things. And they don't store them statically. There's a Second Life Linux users group within Second Life. They meet regularly. Debian's there, of course. Open source information. So you can see they're all, at the moment, fairly basic, but people are getting there, getting involved. They're often not kind of any official presences in any way, but people are wanting to kind of spread the website type information into the virtual worlds.
Okay. All right, this is having a look at something other than Second Life. We'll come back to Second Life a little bit later, I think,
yep.
Yes? So VRML and X3D, so virtual reality modeling language. Back in the 90s, this was going to be the next big thing. We were going to do absolute wonders with VRML, completely open source, open standard. It's basically a markup language to create 3D scalable vector graphics, and by that you could use the code to be able to express what the object should look like. So it should be a cone, it should be of these dimensions, yada, yada, yada. You could also give it geographical information. You could add animations, and you can read all of that. But it was completely scriptable as well. So we could actually create a 3D world. We could make it interactive so you could click on something and then it would perform a certain function. We could create avatars and let them walk down streets and things. Moving on to X3D, which is basically the newest version of VRML. It went through quite a few iterations in that time with VRML 2, VRML 97, I think it was. And now X3D, which is basically an extended VRML, it's using XML notations. It has things like more humanoid animation, so much more realistic animations available. It's got a bit of physics and such to work with your objects to make them seem a lot more realistic. That's about as much as it can. Yep.
I think I just had one of the reasons I think that VRML didn't really take off was that although it promised a lot, people's machines simply couldn't handle it. You needed very high-end graphics hardware, and you still need quite high-end graphics hardware today. But people didn't have the bandwidth, and they didn't have the PCs to be able to do it, unfortunately.
So there was a few worlds or environments that were created using VRML. Actually, there was a heck of a lot created using VRML, but if you go to any websites at the moment looking up VRML virtual worlds or VRML environments, you'll get a stack of links, and about 99.9% of them are broken because they don't exist anymore. There's a bit more in X3D if you go looking for X3D environments and worlds, and here's a couple of the ones that are available at the moment. So Media Machines brought out a couple of applications under the name of Flux. So they've got their Flux Studio, which is for creation of your X3D objects, all of your 3D objects, to be able to create worlds or create environments, create, if you want to build a house, you can create a house in there. If you want to create something that's a little bit more usable, you can do that. We've got a few screenshots around of things that people have created using Flux Studio. So the screenshot at the top right is supposed to be a rock band, and they all sort of play their guitars and do some headbanging and stuff if you actually run it. And it's kind of nice. The one down the bottom here is a little car game, and you can steer it and crash into other cars, and every time you crash into something, it does this huge big flipping roll. Lots of sparks and fire. And it's kind of cute, and yeah, you can import models from other applications. We should have put Blender in there.
Yeah, I'm not sure you can. I guess you can export.
You can export from Blender to any of those ones. Flux Player, which is basically either an external application or it can be used as a plugin within your browser and can be used to run any X3D objects or files that have been created. Flux Player is Windows only, which is very, very painful, and it broke my heart to have to get those screenshots. I was very, very depressed. I had to reboot my machine. And then there's Hydra Server, which is a multi-user support to be able to create something much more along the lines of an actual real virtual world, so that you could add more people and be able to interact with each other in one of those environments. There is Linux source code available.
A lot of those tools, for example, the player and the studio, they're really only segments you need to make a virtual world. There's a technical side of you need a client which can display and navigate these 3D objects, but then you need all the server logic behind it to actually feed those objects to the person, to be able to handle avatars talking to each other, things like inventory, those kind of things. So a lot of these examples are only, you know, partial implementations of what you need to build a real virtual world. One of the cool things about the multi-user Hydra thing was actually released Linux source code to that. And I was doing some evaluations on these kind of products, and it didn't work properly. But because they gave the source code out, I was actually able to edit it, make it work, and do a better evaluation of it. And I think they're starting to see the value of, you know, releasing source code to some of these core components, because they will get more people using it if people can tailor it.
So the reason for the question mark next to Hydra is that we're not actually sure that it's available still. They seem to have stopped doing anything with it.
If you have the source code for the server, it would be fairly easy to find
for
Windows, wouldn't it?
Oh, for Linux, or...?
Sorry, for Linux, yeah.
Well, that's the interesting thing. It's an open protocol. It's X3D, so people can write clients. And many of these examples, you can replace one client with another and still view the X3D. The difficulty comes in when you start getting the virtual world specific things, for example, the chats to each other, sending inventory of some kind to one another, then you need to start making that part of the standard protocol as well.
Which that doesn't really exist.
X3D, is it possible within clients now to add objects to the world? I know that with VRML, you're getting a script, but...
Yeah. It, again, Yeah, that's part of the server implementation. So often these X3D things will be linked in with JavaScript and HTML, and so they could provide some mechanism through that to upload objects. But it's not really the role of X3D to do that in a way. It's you know a larger part.
It very much depends on the actual world as well. So some of these are just an environment to view files that have been created with X3D, and you can't actually get in and walk around them and interact with other people or whatnot. The Hydra is a multi-user environment. But whether they want it to be a closed world where you can't import things or not, or whether they do actually want to allow you to import things, some of them will allow you to do a direct import of models, and some make you FTP it to a server and then call on it from there. So. Free WRL, I couldn't get any screenshots because they only have a Linux client and it didn't work. So, it's promising. It has either the standalone client or the browser plugin. Canadian government developers, it is GPL'd. We can get the source code, we can work on it. Since I was trying to get some screenshots at midnight last night, it didn't happen. So yeah, I didn't get any chance to actually play around with that and try to get it working, so sorry. Anything you want? No. Octaga, this is available in Windows for sale. You have to pay for the Windows environment, but they have free beta versions available inside of Linux and Mac. This will play any X3D files or VRML files. It is proprietary. We couldn't find any decent X3D files to upload because if anybody has used any external textures, graphics files to make it look pretty, it doesn't load them. So there are some, well, they were beta versions for Linux beta clients, so we couldn't actually get that working correctly, and since it's proprietary, no chance of fixing it. Octaga also has modelers, workflow content management, so they sell several products, either the viewer or the other things that you can actually use to create the content. All of the other objects, or all the other products that they sell are all Windows-based only. I guess I can charge more for it that way. XJ3D. This one's completely, totally written in Java. It was written mostly to test the X3D protocol to make sure that things are working correctly.
It's actually used to prototype new additions to X3D as well, so they implemented in XJ3D before getting it into the standard. This was released by Sun, I believe, as part of their Java, so it's LGPL, BSD, GPL, depending on the different components within it. Some of the applications are GPL, but the core of it is BSD or LGPL.
And Blackson, the others were all just basically environments to view or create X3D content. Blackson is actually a virtual world environment. They also sell a series of different products. They sell things that you can create an avatar with, or things that you can create objects with to be able to upload them into Blackson, the virtual world. You can purchase server licenses for Blackson for anything between 3 and 3,000 users. So it's not massively multiplayer, there's not millions of people able to get into it, but it's a secure environment if you wanted to purchase a server and be able to put it on your internal intranet so that only your company can use it to be able to do things like internal training, meetings about customer projects, etc.
One of the examples with tourism is they've built a partial replica of St. Petersburg, and so you can wander in there and kind of see what you'd see if you went on a real tour of St. Petersburg. So that's some of the kind of things which you know companies are starting to experiment with these virtual worlds is virtual tourism, getting people in through being able to show better replications on the internet and hoping they'll come in real life then.
Blackson is also an example of a 3D virtual environment tacked onto a 2D space. It's based on basically a standard text chat engine. You can see a little example of the 2D space down here. You can either view it in 3D or in 2D. The 3D just basically tacks on the 3D images on top of the 2D, so you can still actually access the 2D background. You can do all of your shopping in either 3D or 2D if you wanted to purchase an apartment and put furniture and whatnot into it. So yeah, the picture at the top is an example of somebody's bot that they've purchased with their apartment that they had, and you can script them so that they can give certain answers. If you say a sentence that has the word coffee in it, then this bug, whose name is Bean because of Coffee Bean, will start saying, "Did someone say coffee?" And if you mention decaf, it gets very upset and starts swearing at you. So yeah. So we sell servers. They sell servers on a per user basis, depending how many users you want. Anything else on that one? That's about it with that.
So this is a slide where I get to rant a little bit about 3D support on Linux. I think setting a top five challenges to using virtual world technology on Linux is actually the 3D driver support.
He was going to give a demo today.
I was going to give a demo today. A couple of weeks ago, I thought, you know, I've got the talk coming up. It's time to get my laptop ready to, you know, do a demo for these kind of 3D things. Most of the time when I'm working, I've got a desktop at home. It has an NVIDIA chip, sure, runs a proprietary driver, actually runs reasonably well. Laptop's got an ATI driver in there, and anybody around here who's tried to get 3D and ATI working together knows how much of a headache that can be at times. I accidentally upgraded to Ubuntu Gutsy at some point during the process. Put the latest new drivers on, booted it up, and you know, I've got a 1680 by 1050 screen, and the best it would do was 1280 by 1024, which looks really bad.
So I have 3D working on mine, and mine's actually running at 1920 by 1200, but the second that you try to display it on an external screen, it blows up.
Yeah. So Kelly's using a much older version of the ATR driver, and that has a problem that it's the implementation is not that good, and it tends to freeze a lot, and your whole machine locks up, which is obviously not great.
It's very painful.
A couple of days later, a new version of the ATI driver came out. That's great. They fixed the 1680 by 1050 thing. I thought it was really good. 3D should work. Then I had a look in the release notes and it said, if the size of your screen is not a multiple of 64, then 3D doesn't work. Well, in 1680, so it doesn't work, unfortunately. So you can push it down to a low resolution here and try to connect it to an external display, and of course it doesn't work. So, you know, these are the one of the things which is really, really frustrating. Working with 3D apps every day, you're right at the top of the unstable stack. If you need everything from there to the kernel below, it's very different from when I used to work on kernel development, where all I really needed was, you know, a bit of X up, an editor, and I was fine. But these days, everything on the stack needs to work, and you really see any bits of instability. And the 3D drivers are really the big thing out there.
Sure. And the audio.
And audio, yes. Yep. Yeah.
And video in Second Life.
They're getting better to some extent. ATI has released some, you know, specifications to the card, so maybe in a year or so we'll start to get a lot more stable support out there, but at the moment it can get really frustrating. Lastly, I guess it's the Linux clients. It's convincing people out there to build Linux clients, even if they're not open source yet. Just a Linux client itself makes life a whole lot easier. 3D, again, you know, trying to run 3D stuff in Wine or VMware can be really frustrating. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. Things like Java and Flash aren't so bad, but obviously native is nice if they can do it. One of the great things is a lot of the virtual worlds out there, the servers, they run on Linux. They obviously see the stability of Linux on the server platform as being really useful, and it's really quite encouraging to see that. And I guess that's kind of a foot in the door and saying, you're running the Linux servers, why can't you release a Linux client as well? Okay, next. So I'll talk a little bit about Second Life because it's probably, you know, the major virtual world out there at the moment. Started in 2003 by Linden Labs. Didn't start out having Linux support. That didn't really come out until about 2006. It's very immersive, feels very real once you're in that world. And they're very clear that it's general purpose, it's platform rather than a game. When you look at the content in Second Life, and 99% of it, probably more these days, is generated by the people who participate in Second Life, not by the company who owns it. Linux client got released in 2006, and they released a source code to it in 2007, just around LCA last year. And that was really encouraging to see them recognise that they would gain by working with the open source community. And we've seen, you know, quite a lot of things spun out from that. There's been other clients being released by third parties. One of them last year was, for those who are familiar with the CSI television show, they actually had something run simultaneously in Second Life as well last year with a proprietary client to make it easier for new people to get into it. So it was very tailored specifically for the show, logged them right into the correct place and participate in the show. There's still some proprietary bits used as the main release for the client which they have on Linux. You can build a fully open source one, but there's some issues with performance. I think one of the two main issues which I'm aware of are surprisingly the JPEG decoding library. Apparently, I guess it's really never been pushed under the open source things before, but where you've got a 3D virtual environment, you're downloading lots and lots of textures. You need it to work a lot more efficiently than displaying your standard photos, you know, as you're scrolling through. And the other, I think, is an audio library. But you can compile it with, you know, free libraries if you want. Your performance will just drop a bit. There's the LibSecondLife project, which was started in 2006, and that was basically a reverse engineering effort by people outside of Linden Labs to reverse engineer the protocol. And I've got some slides on that a bit further on. Linden Labs have talked quite a bit about open source and open standards, and numerous times since the client got released, they've been talking about releasing a open source server, although they keep saying the standards are more important. You know, honestly, I kind of expected it to be released by this time this year, but it hasn't happened. But on the bright side, there's been something called OpenSim, which has come out, which is based on LibSecondLife, and I'll talk about that a bit later on, but it's an open source version of the server. It's not nearly as complete as the Linden Labs one, but people can start hosting their own grids if they want to. And one of the issues is that, you know, when they built this, they didn't envision being able to have third parties run these servers, and so to a large extent the servers trust each other. And so if you want an environment where third parties can just arbitrarily connect, you need to change the protocol a bit. So it's kind of like having everybody's web server trusting everybody else's. You can't really work in that environment. So LibSecondLife, it's written in C# BSD license. You can run it on mono, runs pretty well. You can do some kind of cool things like computer controlled avatars. So things you normally need a human to do, you can start getting the computer to do.
Things like bots to automatically respond to questions for different companies.
So one of the ways that we use it in IBM is, you know, when we first got into Second Life, there were maybe a couple hundred people from IBM using Second Life, and there's a special group called 8Bar, which IBM people can join, and they get access to IBM-only areas in Second Life. And, you know, we'd have more and more people join, and people would like look on a wiki, they'd add themselves, their name to a wiki, and someone would go through later and add them to the special group. And when it got to kind of, you know, 3,000-4,000 people, and there are 100 people adding themselves per day, they realised they just couldn't keep up. And someone wrote a little bot using LibSecondLife, so people would add themselves to this wiki, it'll work, they'd work it out and automatically add them to the IBM groups. So one of the advantages they saw, and Linden Labs were actually really good in that they didn't actively oppose the reverse engineering effort. And from what I heard, they actually helped in some areas where there were a bit of crypto on the client side to hide some protocol information, and newer versions would come out and they'd remove the crypto for people. But there were, you know, there were security bugs people found, and that got reported back and fixed. And I understand Linden Labs use LibSecondLife for some testing as well now. Some of the unintended consequences, you know, when you build something like this, you really got to remember that you can't trust the server. And so people were building prims which are much, much larger than
prims being allowed. Primitive objects, so you could create like a box in Second Life and it can only be up to 10 metres by 10 metres, whereas a megaprim might be 256 metres by 256 metres.
CopyBot was something which came up last year. It was a bit of a misunderstanding by non-technical people in Second Life who didn't realise that when people are using the viewer, everything, all the geometry gets downloaded to the client side. It's not just an image which is pushed down. And so they didn't realise that if people really wanted to, they could copy the objects that they saw. And so there's been a bit of, I guess, community awareness now of how these things work on a technical level, and they understand about what you can really do in practical purposes about protecting that kind of information. Ajax Life, this is like a 2D implementation of Second Life, just client side, uses Ajax. Really cool thing is that it was written by a 15-year-old just kind of in his spare time. These are the kind of things which can happen when you release protocols and source code out. So a bit about OpenSIM, I'll just rush through a bit because I think we're running a bit short on time. But this is an open source implementation of the Second Life server. There's grids appearing now where you can get your own box, you contact them, and you can have your OpenSIM Second Life server on the internet where people can come in and do stuff.
Likewise, you can have your OpenSIM Second Life server on your intranet where other people can't access it, so you're completely secure.
It's not nearly mature as the real Second Life service, but it's actually really promising. And I think it's going to encourage the Linden Labs people to release their server code eventually.
It's getting a lot better. Okay, this is going back onto different worlds, other open source worlds. This is built on Squeak, which is based on Smalltalk. It's completely open source and open standards. It's got a license very much like the BSD license. It's peer-to-peer based on the TeaTime engine. God knows what that is, but it's written using Smalltalk. Has lots and lots of applications that are using it. So Quack Forums is a big one that's actually available on the markets at the moment, which we'll get into a little bit more in a moment. Ancient Spaces is where people have rebuilt a whole stack of things like Stonehenge or the pyramids or other things for educational purposes to walk people through. And lots and lots and lots more. These guys have put a lot of focus on interoperability and open standards. They want it to be really, really good. It's very, very cute. So if we have a look at this, this is a couple of screenshots from Croquet where instead of having to, in Second Life, you teleport to different worlds or anything, in Croquet, things are based on Windows. So you can see at the top here, we've got two avatars in here. Christopher was using the dragon, I was using the giraffe. I'm looking through a window here at Christopher. I'm in this really groovy area with all the arches and things in the background. I'm looking through a window at Christopher. He's looking through the window back at me. And then he's just walked straight through the window and he's suddenly in my world. So you can just walk through a window. You can put little different applications, educational games, whatever, inside a little window and walk into it and start using them. It's very cute, but it's not quite enterprise ready yet. Quack Forums, this is based on Croquet. These guys have put a lot onto usability. They want to make this as easy for newcomers to come into and just start working on. So inside of Quack Forums, you can do things like, in Second Life, if you wanted to show a presentation, you have to export your PowerPoint or OpenOffice slides into different images and import every one of those images as a separate image, put them onto a PowerPoint presenter sort of thing, and then start using it. In Quack Forums, you drag and drop directly from your desktop onto Quack Forums. It uses OpenOffice in the background to convert it and do everything for you, and you've got a display there ready to show. It's very pretty. They've had a recent announcement on, I think, the 27th of November last year that somebody's given them $7 million to put into development. Runs on a Linux server, only has a Windows client, which is very sad.
One of the interesting things about the way they ship the product is it's not a Debian package, it's not an RPM, it's not a tarball. They actually ship you a VMware image of the entire Linux machine and you just run it in VMware. So that's probably an indication to the community about the problems that some people are having with getting dependencies right for packages, that they just decided, you know, it's easier to ship the whole image.
So I've put in there that they're rapidly changing and adding things like sophisticated avatars, and that's because in worlds like Second Life and the likes, people really, really associate themselves with their avatars. Not everybody does, but a lot of people really like to make it a little mini-me or a mini-what-I-want-to-be or a mini-what-I'd-never-be, but I think it's really hilarious. So a lot of people put a lot of work into their avatars, and as you can see in Quack Forums, it's not quite there yet, but they're working on it. In Quack Forums at the moment, they all look like that. IBM is using Quack Forums at the moment to do some customer work. So a lot of our customers are coming up and saying we want to do a little internal, our own private virtual world inside of Quack Forums just for us. So we are doing work in that space. Christopher.
So Project Dark Star, Project Wonderland, this is something which is pretty recent, released from Sun. It's all written in Java again, it's fully GPL, almost the entire stack, and it's a toolkit for writing 3D virtual worlds. It hasn't been out that long, so we haven't had a good chance to evaluate it, but from what I've seen, it looks pretty nice. They use it for their virtual workplace. As they say, they've got a lot of people working from home. They've got a lot of people out there who have difficulty getting in contact with each other. And it's the informal communication which is most valuable often between technical people as well. And this gives them an environment to be able to do that. So they can have their virtual office, they can be thousands of miles apart, and they can be sitting next to each other in this virtual world and still chat to each other. So kind of quickly about what IBM's doing in the open source, open standards line. Involved in Kronos, which works on 3D standardization. One of them's Collada, which is a format for interchange format for 3D objects. We're involved with Linden Labs in their architecture working group, so trying to settle down some of the architecture for Second Life in terms of protocols, low-level protocols, those kind of things.
One of the big things with virtual worlds and standards and protocols at the moment is that everybody uses their own, so it's kind of like if you go to a web browser and you need a web page and you need a different browser to view every web page you go to. If you go to Google, you'll need the Google browser, and if you go to a newspaper site, you'll need their own browser, and so far all of the virtual worlds are like that because there are no standards between them.
We're doing quite a bit of work with OpenSim now, so we've got an OpenSim grid on our intranet for experimentation with, so we can have, you know, confidential meetings behind the intranet without needing to worry about people listening into conversations. We can have conferences in there, and we've got approval now to contribute patches back to the OpenSim project through the Linux Technology Centre. So mostly working on things like stability, those kind of things. Interoperability with Second Life is also an important aspect for us. And things like PowerPC cell optimization. A lot of the actions which you see within the virtual world servers, like physics, those kind of things, would be really well suited to that kind of architecture. So that's something we're looking at. Okay. And lastly is the avatar service, which you might have heard about. It's basically the idea is there'll be a central repository for avatars. Part of that's authentication. So rather than having, you know, 10 virtual worlds, 10 different usernames and passwords, you can just go through the central side and log in once and go from virtual world to virtual world. Moving inventories, any objects you collect in Second Life, you might want to take them over to, I don't know, World of Warcraft or something like that. And this kind of service can moderate to do that. A communication between virtual worlds. Obviously, something like this really needs, you know, standardization of protocols for it to be done well. But it can act as a broker in some ways to kind of glue things together. So I think we're basically out of time, but are there any kind of last questions?
I did sort of like a helping in Lindy McCullough's PhD project. One of the other people doing that was a teacher in Queensland who had a space in Second Life where he made an island and a building to serve some students. And he also made the same space using a mud loop text space.
Yep.
And I thought that was really exciting in terms of if there was a virtual world that was able to do that kind of really standards-based approach, that could do a text-based parallel for the very visual kind of space that might be interesting for accessibility and
yes.
Other ways, like Jason was talking about the other day, about having information and being able to
Yeah, that's exactly where we need standardization and accessibility. I don't think anyone's really looked well into that for virtual worlds because, you know, how do you do that?
But yeah. I thought that was a really interesting way for the teacher to have thought about it, but they actually said, well, here's the space and now I'm doing it in this context. They were manually doing it in a sort of like,
you know,
walk left, walk right.
Yeah.
It actually also models a whole school
realm. Wow.
Well,
that's the interesting thing. There's so much content being created in worlds like Second Life or Active Worlds.
Yeah.
People are going to want to get them out one day, and we need the processes to be able to do that. Thank you. anything? Or
now, Marco, you have something coming up on open source Second Life Community?
Yes, I've got a lightning talk where I'll just mention the URL. We have a small blog, which is essentially to allow Linux users to get into Second Life a lot easier, because it's a couple of hurdles at times. And we intend to have tutorials on how to use open source tools to make content for Second Life. And we have a small area that's still being built, it's not really ready, within Second Life, where we'll provide a lot of tools and scripts and things that you can use to make building and doing stuff in Second Life a lot easier. So I'll just put the URL up there for lightning talk for that.
So yeah, so people definitely, if you're interested in Second Life and interested in helping develop the Linux Australia presence in Second Life, you know, email one of us, contact us, and we can give you directions and building rights and those kind of things.
Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.